With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
March 1st, all hogs and pigs is at 74.3 million head, up 0.4% from previous year inventory.
Travis Averill is chief of the livestock branch at USDA's National Ag Statistics Service on the latest hogs and pigs report.
Breeding hogs is at 5,892,000 head, a decrease of 0.5% from 2025. The market hogs is at 68.4 million head, up 0.6% from last year. So in the bottom left-hand corner, we have the top five states. As you can see, Iowa and Minnesota are the top two, and they're up 2 and 3% respectively from previous year, whereas North Carolina, Illinois, and Indiana wrap up the top five, and they're down 5%, 4%, and 1% from previous year's inventory for the respective states.
Averill says productivity gains helping offset the smaller breeding base. December through February pick crop, 33.2 million head, up 1% from last year, and pigs saved per litter increasing to 11.9 compared to 11.6 a year earlier, and that improvement continues a trend of higher efficiency across the sector. And Indonesia and the U.S., new trade framework could expand market access for American ag, particularly in oil seeds, grains, and dairy products. Analysis by the Center for North American Studies at Texas A&M shows that the agreement would eliminate tariffs on 99% of U.S. exports to Indonesia, while U.S. tariffs on Indonesian imports would remain at 19%. That move targets both tariff and non-tariff barriers, aiming to improve competitiveness for U.S. products in a growing Southeast Asian market. Trade flows, well, they highlight the opportunity. U.S. ag exports to Indonesia, totaling $2.89 billion last year, led by oil seeds and grains and feed. Dairy, cotton, and ag chemicals also represent smaller but important categories. USDA conservation funding continues to grow, offering more opportunities for producers, though the ways those dollars reach the farm vary widely by both program and timing. Now, a new USDA Economic Research Service report shows conservation funding reached about $5.7 billion annually, with roughly 90% concentrated in three programs: Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program. Additional support from the Inflation Reduction Act added more than $19 billion in supplemental funding through 2031, and it expands available resources for conservation practices. Now, conservation programs expected to remain a key part of farm policy moving forward, though participation and impact will continue to depend on program design and how it fits on farm. And finally, a softer U.S. dollar providing only modest support for ag exports, with underlying support and demand remaining primary drivers of trade. Analysis from terrain economist Matt Clark shows the U.S. dollar index declining more than 12% since early 2025, typically a signal of improved export competitiveness, but he says that index now heavily weighted towards currencies like the euro, yen, and pound, and that accounts for a relatively small share for U.S. ag trade. It's Agriculture Today.
Let's talk about supply chains. Each year, Cotton Incorporated's global supply chain marketing team has hundreds of meetings with brands and retailers in all corners of the globe. They're working to find innovative ways to replace synthetic fabrics with natural, sustainable cotton, to expand your customer base and drive more demand. You grow the cotton. The Cotton Research and Promotion Program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at DeltaPine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
This is Agriculture Today.
At Terrain, we have been calling 2026 a high-stakes year for cattle feeders.
Bree Botts is a grain and oilseed analyst at Terrain.
Margins matter. That means having a plan for your feed cost matters, too. Our early outlook for the 2026-27 crop includes some risks toward higher corn prices, but steady to lower prices for soybean meal and dry distiller grains with solubles, or DDGS. The corn market finished the 2025 U.S. growing season with ample supplies. Large planted acreage and record yields produced a record crop, keeping harvest prices under pressure. Since then, record supplies have been met with record demand, and average cash prices have risen modestly. Exports remain the primary price support. The USDA's current estimate is for exports to total a record 3.3 billion bushels for the 2025 crop marketing year. Corn use for ethanol also continues to be robust, although DDG's exports were softer, down over 4% over last year, primarily due to reduced sales to China. Our current forecast is for slightly higher corn prices over the next 6 months. The market is currently pricing in comfortable supplies and steady demand. Lower corn prices would require either noticeably weaker consumption, another above-trend production year for the 2026 crop, or both. The market has more upside risk. Markets are now paying attention to South America ahead of U.S. planting. Weather risks in Argentina and the formation of Brazil's second crop corn remain central to global supply expectations. An increasing share of Brazil's second crop corn is being consumed domestically in corn-based ethanol production. That shift tightens export availability and contributes to growing DDG supplies outside of the U.S. Brazil recently began exporting DDGs to China and will likely continue to pressure U.S. global market share. If U.S. exports decline, prices could follow, providing opportunities to increase DDGs in our domestic feed rations. For 2026, Terrain projects U.S. corn acreage to decline to about 94 million acres. Recent price movements in January and early February might push more acres to soybeans and lower our corn acreage estimates. Final February crop insurance prices and weather will help determine final acre decisions. Even a small reduction in corn acres could make a meaningful adjustment to U.S. supplies. In that scenario, yields slightly below trend in 2026 could move prices noticeably higher later in the year. Even at trend yields, the expected acre reduction from last year removes about 900 million bushels from our early estimate for 2026-27 supplies. There may be basis risk ahead too. For the 2025 crop, corn production in the Western Corn Belt was 18-73% above the five-year average, contributing to the wheat corn basis across much of this region. If the east-west production balance normalizes in the year ahead, this basis could move toward more normal levels, adding to the average price risk already discussed. While supplies are adequate today, the risk buffer for higher prices may be more fragile than it appears if corn acreage slips or weather turns adverse. Soybean prices remain volatile. Uncertainty around U.S. biofuel policy and the pace of Chinese purchases have contributed to sharp price movements, and this volatility is likely to persist in the coming months. Brazil's expanding soybean production, potentially a record crop, continues to weigh on prices. If China's purchases slow or shift more heavily toward South America, the U.S. export pace could soften, encouraging additional domestic crush. Growing use of soybean oil for biofuel supports this domestic crush, increasing soybean meal supplies and keeping protein feeds relatively affordable into 2026. Similarly, strong ethanol production is providing abundant DDGS supplies.
It's Agriculture Today.
Manage your risk and take advantage of opportunities with StoneX. Utilizing StoneX's global presence to provide the best in market intelligence, a vast portfolio of risk management and marketing products, and a team of brokers who specialize in working with those in agriculture, StoneX provides the resources you need to make the best possible decisions. Learn more about the StoneX Advantage. Call Donna Hughes at 214-613-1688. There's substantial risk to futures and options trading. Not all products are suitable for all producers.
Purple Wave Auction remains the trusted leader in online equipment auctions. What makes the difference is you. You are part of our growing global community that continues to trust Purple Wave with the equipment that builds and feeds America. This trust placed in us by our community, from construction to ag producers and fleet drivers, brings great equipment opportunities to their next owners. Join the Purple Wave community today. PurpleWave.com.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's a big change. I think it's also important, though, even as we're looking at the new model, to take stock and look backward and recognize how much of dairy's current success, including those fantastic export figures, you have been built on those prior bigger agreements.
Shauna Morris is Executive Vice President for Trade Policy, National Milk Producers Federation, says today's trade deals are not traditional trade deals.
A lot of those exports go to countries that benefit, where our exporters are benefiting from World Trade Organization trading terms. Another whole host of them go to U.S. free trade agreement partners. But that definitely was a model for a certain era, and it's not the model that we have right now. I think one of the big shifts we've seen, particularly under this administration, has been a movement away from trying to pursue deals that have to eventually go through congressional approval, into instead being focused on ones that simply can be done unilaterally from the administration side. We saw that type of playbook run under Trump 1.0 with the sort of targeted deal they negotiated with Japan. And that's the playbook here for all of these reciprocal agreements. What can get done simply under administration say-so and negotiating prerogative doesn't have to ultimately go up to the Hill to get their rubber stamp too. So that shifts a little bit who we need to work with. Congress remains important. That's definitely a key audience for us as we're advocating. What do we want to see out of some of these agreements? Which markets are important for U.S. dairy? But a little bit less so, honestly, because at the end of the day, the administration knows that they're not having to send this up for an up or down vote from the House and the Senate. And so a lot more of our focus and attention has been on working with the administration and making sure we're detailing out what do we want to see. And I'd say also a shift for us has been trying to do that a little bit more proactively. This administration has been negotiating with so many countries in parallel, a lot bigger volume than we've seen in the past through these individual bilateral agreements. So making sure that we're prepared and we've already armed in advance the negotiating teams with dairy's priorities has been a focus for us. So for instance, we took some time at the very start of Trump 2.0 last year to put together key markets, key product areas, major non-tariff barriers, and package those together so that wherever they went on the negotiating drive as things unfolded, they had our top lines to be able to start the process from.
And she actually has an interesting role in helping to craft these deals.
Jaime Castaneda and I from our team, together with USDEX, Krista Harden, and then a few members from National Milk, as well as from the U.S. Dairy Export Council, serve in these official confidential trade advisor capacity roles. So that means that there's been an application process and security clearance run on all of us so that we can view text while it's still in the negotiating process and feed into that with the U.S. Trade Representative's office, with the Department of Agriculture staff, while talks are still unfolding. And that's absolutely vital in our view. You know, once the agreement's done, you see what it says. Hopefully it's good to react to. And of course, before talks start, we can do that preparatory feeding in process. But it's essential that we be able to have these confidential discussions protected from FOIA, given the sensitivity of the matters, so that on a real-time basis, while talks are advancing, we're able to react to particular proposals and help the negotiating team fine-tune some of the language or ideas that they're working to advance.
It's Agriculture Today.
Introducing the heavyweight champion of the livestock operation, Case IH Farmall Utility Series Tractors.
Farmall Utility Tractors don't just outweigh the competition. They're engineered to distribute weight where it works, from the transmission, central housing, and axles to the differentials and final drives. So add some weight to your operation and go the distance with Farmall Utility Tractors.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
This has been Scott, Scott Land Company in Dimmitt, Texas. We have literally sold thousands of acres of grassland in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Our inventory on ranches is as low as it has been in years. We really need listings on ranches of all sizes. Look at our website, scottlandcompany.com. Give us a call at 800-933-9698.
with Agriculture Today. Here's Tony St. James.
I'm not a political guy. Don't like politics. Don't like politicians.
Mark Meckler is president of the Convention of States.
Many years ago, back in 2009, I watched a guy sort of go off and rant on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. His name was Rick Santelli. And he was talking about how out of control the federal government was, how unjust it was to regular people. And that resonated with me. I was frustrated, but not engaged in politics. But that rant and the subsequent times that evolved after that led me to start something called the Tea Party Movement. Some of your listeners, viewers might remember that. And I ended up growing an organization called the Tea Party Patriots, 23 million members, 3,200 chapters. And the entire point of the organization was just to empower regular people. I've always found Washington, D.C. and all the politicians and lobbyists and bureaucrats very frustrating. And my goal was just take power away from them and give it back to the people and the states. By 2012, it was pretty obvious that wasn't going to happen. So I started looking for alternatives. If just voting and just putting people into office isn't enough, then you got to ask yourself, well, what is? What can we do? And it turns out there's a mechanism in the Constitution in Article 5, and it gives us, the people acting through the states, the power to call a convention of states. It's really extraordinary. We've never done it before. You can do it. You call this convention, and in convention, you can propose amendments to the Constitution. And the amendments we're trying to get are things that are common sense to the vast majority of American people. Term limits on Congress and bureaucrats, a balanced budget amendment, spending restraints, tax caps, things, everything everybody wants, and even a limitation on the power of the federal government. I think it comes in to the ag conversation here. Like, I don't understand why the federal government tells farmers and ranchers what to do. If that's going to be regulated, it should be regulated at the state and local level. So we're trying to call this convention, get the states together. It takes 34 states to call it. So far, 20 states have done it. So we're well on our way. And I think it is hope for farmers and ranchers, people who work the land.
So why is he focused on ag?
I come from a rural area. I have been around farmers and ranchers and cattlemen and horse folks my whole life. And so I have a heart for that. I also, from a political perspective, understand that this country, it was not built by bureaucrats and politicians. I think that's self-evident, but I got to say it today. It was built by people who were willing to get their hands dirty and literally pull this country up out of the dirt with their bare hands. Those are farmers and ranchers and miners and energy people. And I think even in my own lifetime, I've watched those people go from being what I would describe as kind of common man, everyman heroes to being vilified in the media. And it drives me crazy. I think people need to stand up and speak for those folks. If it weren't for them, we don't eat. Our houses aren't warmed. We don't have fuel for our cars. We don't have clothing. Everything that we rely on in this country for the basic necessities all comes from all of those people. So for me, I have a passion for what happens to those folks. And then my son got married recently, and he quintessentially married the farmer's daughter. And so we married into a farm family up in Luray, Missouri, up in the northeast corner of Missouri. They farm a 6,000 acre farm up there. And so we've gotten a lot closer to the farming community. We've had a chance to see it up close, to be with our in-laws and talk to them about the hardships they face and the difficulties they face. And I think that most Americans don't understand that. And you ask most Americans, where does your food come from? They think it comes from the grocery store. And they don't understand how difficult it is being a farmer or rancher in today's environment. So that causes me to keep a very close eye on everything going on in Washington, D.C. that affects the farm community.
It's Agriculture Today.
Let's talk about supply chains. Each year, Cotton Incorporated's global supply chain marketing team has hundreds of meetings with brands and retailers in all corners of the globe. They're working to find innovative ways to replace synthetic fabrics with natural, sustainable cotton to expand your customer base and drive more demand. You grow the cotton. The Cotton Research and Promotion Program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at DeltaPine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, if we think about the general enrollment and the continuous enrollment, it's effectively a rental rate. There's an annual payment for land enrolled in the CRP. And at least originally in the general enrollment, that was, as I mentioned, a competitively bid process.
Brad Lubin is an economist at the University of Nebraska.
But you are comparing a potential rental rate for putting land into CRP and having to manage it to maintain cover and so forth. But you were comparing that to the potential returns from cropping that land. And so the economics of crop returns versus this potential guaranteed 10-year payment from USDA for enrolling land in the CRP was an economic decision. And enrollments went up maybe when prices, commodity prices were lower. When commodity prices rebounded, enrollments came back down. Interestingly enough, in the early 2000s, we were concerned about how many acres might be coming out of the CRP at expiration in one big fell swoop. So concerned about it that USDA trotted out a program called the Re-Enrollment and Extension Offer Program, or RECS, if anybody remembers acronyms. But RECS was offered in about 2005 to try and slow down the number of acres that were going to quickly expire from the CRP. Arguably, no sooner did those contracts get signed to re-enroll or extend some acres, then commodity prices took off with the biofuels boom and some good fundamental market opportunities. And people started asking questions about how quickly one could take land out of the CRP. So ideas about potential early exits and so forth. So the interest in the CRP, at least in the general enrollment, has arguably been driven by commodity prices and comparing returns of cropping versus returns of putting something into the CRP. The continuous enrollment is more of a calculation of, is this particular parcel, this subfield parcel, is it better off in cropping over the long run, or is it better off in a conserving use? Because the marginal economics there tend to be pretty attractive. Producers could put it in without competing, which meant they could put it in at the maximum acceptable rental rate for that particular class of land. It really did attract very specific targeted environmental opportunities. Now, the grassland CRP doesn't offer a full rental rate to producers. It's more of an incentive or stewardship rate to manage the parcel and to maintain good practices. But it certainly offers a great opportunity to grazing land, pasture and grazing land owners that want to more effectively manage their operation for both environmental and production purposes.
But how is CRP used today? Lubin explains.
If we're thinking about land that goes into the CRP in the general or continuous enrollment, those are long-term contracts, typically 10 or maybe up to 15 years. And some of that land, as it eventually expires from the CRP, the question is what happens to it from that point. In some cases, it's bid for re-enrollment in the continuous provisions, or maybe re-enrolled in continuous CRP for some new practices or new activities. In some cases, it does come back to production. There is even in something called the Transition Incentives Program, which tries to match up landowners with retiring CRP contracts with beginning farmers, such that the landowner can receive some incentives to bring that, if that land's coming back into production, to bring it back to a beginning farmer rancher qualifies them for some additional incentives.
It's Agriculture Today.
Manage your risk and take advantage of opportunities with StoneX. Utilizing StoneX's global presence to provide the best in market intelligence, a vast portfolio of risk management and marketing products, and a team of brokers who specialize in working with those in agriculture, StoneX provides the resources you need to make the best possible decisions. Learn more about the StoneX Advantage. Call Donna Hughes at 214-613-1688. There's substantial risk to futures and options trading. Not all products are suitable for all producers.
Purple Wave Auction remains the trusted leader in online equipment auctions. What makes the difference is you. You are part of our growing global community that continues to trust Purple Wave with the equipment that builds and feeds America. This trust placed in us by our community, from construction to ag producers and fleet drivers, brings great equipment opportunities to their next owners. Join the Purple Wave community today. PurpleWave.com.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Beef and cattle prices have been trading at record levels. Choice Box Beef is up 15% this year through March versus the same period last year. And cattle prices are up 18 to 40%, depending on class.
Dave Weber is Senior Animal Protein Analyst with Terrain.
The reductions in available slaughter capacity so far this year have shifted leverage to the packing segment and improved its margins. However, if the Iran war's effect on consumer gas budgets persists, it could challenge beef spending. The reduction in fed cattle slaughter capacity materialized with Tyson closing the Lexington, Nebraska beef plant and taking its Amarillo, Texas facility down to a single shift in January. As we expected, the shrinking number of shackles and plants didn't immediately solve packers' heavy losses. Fed cattle packing margins worsened from the second week of January through the third week of February as five area steer prices rallied from $232 a hundredweight to $247 a hundredweight, and choice box beef cutout values were nearly flat. During the same period, fed steer and heifer slaughter dropped to a historically small average of 433,000 head per week, down 10% from a year earlier. The packers' slowing of slaughter has resulted in more surplus cattle, most notably in northern feeding areas. While the increase isn't particularly burdensome, it is enough to show up in heavier carcass weights, which is contrary to the seasonal trend, and a higher percentage of choice and prime grading carcasses. As a result, bargaining position has shifted to the packers' favor. Small cattle on feed inventories in the Southern Plains and Colorado appear to have limited the oversupply in these areas as the live cattle basis continues to strengthen in the Southern Plains. News of the strike at the JBS facility in Greeley, Colorado, alongside cooler cleanups and other plants, pressured live cattle futures prices and, eventually, five-area live cattle prices lower in March. The wholesale box beef market experienced a supply shock, getting the spring beef rally started ahead of grilling season. Feeder cattle futures haven't fared much worse than live cattle markets on a dollar-per-head basis, but they have declined about $20 per hundredweight versus the $10 a hundredweight for live cattle. As a result, feeder steer values dropped about $150 a head. I still project that the average Oklahoma City feeder steer purchased the second week of March will lose more than $300 per head. Real per capita beef spending remained record high through 2025. Retail beef prices, both choice and all fresh, were record high in February. Retailers will likely continue to increase prices in the beef case, anticipating continued higher cutout values due to the tightening supplies. While fundamental market factors, tight cattle supplies, lower beef production, and strong consumer spending, remain supportive of cattle prices, external factors have begun to lean bearish and add volatility to the marketplace. For one, the military action in Iran has a direct effect on consumers' fuel budgets. Consumer confidence has already taken a hit because of ongoing affordability concerns and declines in investment and retirement accounts. This combination has the potential to limit consumer spending on beef items at grocery stores and restaurants. I expect cattle slaughter in Q2 2026 to run 4 to 6% below year earlier levels and beef production in Q3 2026 to run 2.5 to 5% below 2025 levels. The increase in average fed cattle dressed weights will likely offset 2.5 to 3% of the slaughter decline. In this scenario, continued record high imports could cause net beef supplies and per capita consumption to increase 0.5 to 2% for the middle two quarters of 2026. Rising retail prices during the summer will equate to continued robust beef demand. I expect fed cattle prices to average $250 per hundredweight to $255 per hundredweight, with a range of $245 to $265 per hundredweight in Q2 and close to $260 per hundredweight in Q3. This will likely lead to slight profits for cattle marketed during Q2 and similar size losses in Q3.
It's Agriculture Today.
Introducing the heavyweight champion of the livestock operation, Case IH Farmall Utility Series Tractors.
Farmall Utility Tractors don't just outweigh the competition. They're engineered to distribute weight where it works, from the transmission, central housing, and axles to the differentials and final drives. So add some weight to your operation and go the distance with Farmall Utility Tractors.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
This has been Scott, Scott Land Company in Dimmitt, Texas. We have literally sold thousands of acres of grassland in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Our inventory on ranches is as low as it has been in years. We really need listings on ranches of all sizes. Look at our website, scottlandcompany.com. Give us a call at 800-933-9698.